This podcast is sponsored by Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management, award-winning wealth managers who go above and beyond to support and guide you. Visit candowealth.com to start building your wealth with confidence.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shops, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and this is the Sunday Roundup. Former Prime Minister David Cameron has been hitting the headlines again recently, but for all the wrong reasons. His attempt to lobby the Chancellor on behalf of the now defunct Greensill Capital has opened a whole can of worms about potential conflicts of interest and business influence over the civil service. Andrew Marr was joined by the Environment Secretary George Eustace and asked him about Cameron's infamous Treasury texts.
Do you think that what David Cameron has done is acceptable?
Well, look, I think the key thing is he's not broken any of the rules. And you'll
That's not what I'm asking.
Well, I think...
Do you think it was acceptable?
Well, it is acceptable, obviously, for people to work within the rules. Well, I think the point I would make is ministers, as they leave office, including prime ministers, aren't allowed to take any such paid roles for a period of 2 years. These are rules that David Cameron himself brought in. He left office some 5 years ago, and you can't begrudge people taking and moving on to do another career. Well, the question is whether...
Is that other career? Let's just remind ourselves that he texted twice the serving Chancellor of the Exchequer. This is the former Prime Minister, texts privately the Chancellor of the Exchequer to see if he can get extra money out of the government for a company that is paying him a lot of money in which he's got shares, that's Greensill. And he organises separately a private drink with the health secretary, again pushing the interests of that company. I suggest to you that this, to a lot of people, appears to be a very undue amount of influence from a former prime minister on behalf of a company which has now gone bust, and that, to quote one of my colleagues, it doesn't pass the smell test or the sniff test.
Well, look, he himself conceded that he probably, with hindsight, should have written in a more formal way in a letter through the private office. But the real question here is, you know, what did the Chancellor do when he was contacted? Well, he flagged a conversation with his officials. He asked them to look at it. The answer came back that no, nothing could be done. The company didn't fit the criteria. The company was told, we're not going to help you, and it went bust.
Eustace also had to field similar questions from Sophie Ridge about the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock.
So he owns 15% of the shares in a firm called Topwood. Now, that's a company where his sister is a director. It's also approved as a supplier for the NHS. Is that really acceptable?
Well, of course, the reason we know about this is that Matt Hancock did exactly what all ministers would do in this case, which is to declare that interest. And so he did the right thing. He's declared that. He's had no role whatsoever in any procurement around this business. So, yes, there's nothing wrong with ministers having financial interests, provided they declare them in the appropriate way.
And so provided as long as you declare it. You can do whatever you want.
No,
is that how it works?
As long as you declare it and then have no role, obviously, in any procurement decisions around that company. That's the important thing here. You know, the important thing is much more how do ministers act and conduct themselves in these situations if there is a potential conflict. Well, the thing they should do is make sure they remove all of that conflict by ensuring they have no role whatsoever in decisions surrounding such companies. But secondly, declare it so there can be no perception that they might. And so he's done what you'd expect someone to do in that case.
You say there's no perception of a conflict of interest because he's declared it. You know, I'm not suggesting that Matt Hancock's broken the rules here. As you say, he's followed the rules. But some people looking at this might think that if a health secretary can own a sizable chunk of shares in a company run by his sister that is then a supplier for the department which he is the head of, then it's the rules themselves that are broken.
Well, I'm not sure actually that I would agree with that. Obviously, look, ministers can move around a lot. Famously, we tend not to spend you know, too long in one particular role. Sometimes a minister will be given a position and may have a long-standing financial interest that they therefore need to declare. I don't think that was the case in this one, but that is often the case. And so they declare it in the usual way and then remove themselves from any decisions that that might affect their own, you know, financial interests. And as far as I can see, that's exactly what Matt Hancock did. I mean, the reason we know about this, the reason it's being talked about, is because he declared it and he did the right thing.
Eustace went on to defend both the current setup and the review into Cameron's conduct.
There are several parliamentary committees looking at this. I think the right thing to do is for these reviews to go through their process, to conclude, to work out exactly what did and did not happen. And then, yes, of course, there may come a time After that, when it's right to consider tweaks to policy. But fundamentally, I think that the systems we have in place with ministers declaring interest, with the ministerial code, and the focus on that and how ministers conduct themselves in office is actually a pretty good one. But that's not to say that you couldn't make tweaks or changes. And obviously there'll be a time and a place for that after these reviews have concluded.
Let's talk about the Boardman review, shall we? Because I understand that it is quite helpful for when, you know, ministers like yourself do these rounds, that you can point towards the fact that the, you know, the Boardman review has been set up. At the same time, though, it's got no power to sanction, no statutory or legal force, and it's strictly limited to looking at the Greensill affair. I mean, it sounds a bit toothless, doesn't it?
Well, no, I think it's actually the right thing to do, because the, you know, the worst thing for ministers is to say that they think everything's OK and then suddenly it turns out that there are other details that emerge. And so the Prime Minister, I think quite rightly, has said, let's get to the bottom of this.
Will you commit to implementing what the review...
Well, I don't think the review is going to make policy recommendations, but of course there are other... reviews going on in Parliament.
What's the point of it then? If it has no powers, it's not going to make policy recommendations. What's the point of it?
Well, because people are raising questions about what happened in this particular instance around Greensill, both because there was a...
There was
a civil servant, Bill Crothers, who at one point was working for the civil service and had a role in Greensill. So that is something that's being looked at. And obviously there's been a lot of questions raised about David Cameron's contacts with ministers. So the purpose of the review is to answer the questions that people are asking.
Ridge also interviewed Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, and confronted her with the figures for deaths from drug abuse, which are roughly 3.5 times as high as the proportions in England and Wales.
Scotland suffers more drug deaths per capita than any other European country, over 1,200 people dying of drug misuse last year. That's a record high for the sixth year in a row. How is that acceptable?
It's not, and I've been very candid about that. We have tried to tackle the drugs deaths, but we can't look at the figures for the numbers of people dying and conclude that what we have done has been enough or has been effective enough. So over the past few months, we've done a number of things to make a concerted attempt to turn this around. So firstly, I have appointed a dedicated minister with responsibility for this, reporting directly to me. We have set aside a budget over the next few years of £250 million to specifically support initiatives to tackle the drugs crisis and drugs deaths, and that is supporting more community work. It is supporting greater provision of rehabilitation beds, including residential rehabilitation and aftercare support, faster access to treatment so that if somebody comes forward looking for treatment, they get that quickly and aren't having to wait for that. So there is a whole package of policies and interventions now that we are taking forward to turn it around, because to be frank, it's not acceptable. And you know, you can make choices as a politician. You can be confronted with something like that and try to dig your heels in and defend the indefensible, or you can do what I think is better and admit that this is an area where we have not done well enough and we're determined to do better in future.
Ridge went on to ask about Sturgeon's predecessor as First Minister, Alex Salmond, who is now running for the new ALBA party in May's elections to Holyrood. Ridge wanted to know if they would be burying the hatchet in pursuit of independence.
In the spirit of respectful discourse, if ALBA does win seats at the election, would you work with Alex Salmond?
No, I'm not going to work with Alex Salmond. Firstly, I have concerns about his personal conduct that he hasn't acknowledged or apologised for. As I've just said, I don't agree with the approach to independence, because I think it is more, or it is risking putting people off rather than bringing people towards us. There's no shortcut to independence. We've got to do it through winning a majority and allowing that majority to express itself in a legitimate process. I also don't know what ALBA stands for. For me, independence is not an end in itself. It's a means to a better Scotland, a fair, equal Scotland, where we value everybody who lives here for who they are. And I don't know what ALBA stands for, but from what I've seen so far, I probably would have some concerns about that.
Marr spoke to the Russian ambassador, Andrei Kelin, about Russia's military mobilisations with regards to Ukraine. Ukrainian intelligence estimates that there are now 40,000 heavily armed Russian troops on the country's eastern border, with a further 40,000 in Crimea.
it just sounds and looks quite aggressive and ominous. The deputy head of your presidential administration says this: the start of military action would be the beginning of the end of Ukraine. Doesn't that build up a picture of either intimidation or full-scale aggression coming?
Our Minister of Foreign Affairs and also spokesman by the President has repeatedly said, and I can confirm it, that we have no intention at all to be aggressive or and we do not threat to any country, including the Ukraine. We are fully committed to an idea of the Minsk agreements, and it should be reached only by in a negotiated way.
So why that ominous, menacing phrase, the beginning of the end of Ukraine?
Probably it has been mentioned in certain context. I haven't seen the context, but I can imagine that if Ukrainian forces or Ukrainian government will decide to move troops in Donbas and to make a bloodbath over there to kill people, to kill Russians, of course, we are going to respond.
And finally, the Shadow Cabinet Office Minister Rachel Reeves launched an attack on Tory sleaze, but found herself on the defensive when faced with the waiving of the rules for the former First Minister of Wales, Carwyn Jones.
Let's stick, if we may, with the Advisory Committee on Ministerial Business Appointments, ACBOA. You said it was essential that people abided by that. Can I ask you, therefore, about Carwyn Jones, the former First Minister of Wales? He took a job with Liberty Steel's parent company. Now, Liberty Steel is completely connected to the Greensill affair. He was told by ACBOA he could not take that job, and yet he did. What's your response?
Well, his role at Liberty was particularly around energy issues and steel issues and had no connection to what was going on at Greensill. The Greensill stuff only came out later. They were funding Liberty. That's not who Carwyn Jones was working for.
Well,
and you know, when we're here today because of sleaze at the heart of government, because of David Cameron's lobbying for private interest, because he stood to gain tens of millions of pounds lobbying if he had succeeded.
So you say the Carwyn Jones thing doesn't matter or whatever. ACOBA wrote to Mr. Jones in these terms, and this is a direct quote: the committee considers that joining the GFG Alliance, which is the body concerned, Global Advisory Board, whilst you are subject to the government's business appointment rules, is contrary to its advice. You are in breach of the government's business appointment rules, and he ignored them. Why do you think he ignored them?
Well, look, that's something for you to ask Carwyn Jones. I can't answer that question. But we are here today because of sleaze engulfing the government at the heart of what is going on in government. Look, I would like Sir Eric Pickles and the Advisory Committee on Business Appointments to have more powers.
To go after Carwyn Jones, to go after perhaps Mark Drayford, who agreed that he didn't have to, that he could ignore these rules.
Well, look, I think there are different rules in place in Wales compared with the government in the United Kingdom. And Carwyn Jones had any relationship at all with Greensill. And he was not lobbying government ministers. I think this is the crucial point, Andrew. This is the crucial point here, that he wasn't lobbying for commercial interests of Welsh ministers or of British government ministers. That is very different from what we've seen from David Cameron.
That's all for this week. I'm Isabel Hardman, and this podcast was produced by Matthew Taylor. Don't forget to subscribe to the Coffee House Shots podcast on the iTunes Store. And if you enjoyed this podcast, do subscribe to our daily Evening Blend email. It's a free roundup of all the political news each day, along with analysis and a diary on what to expect next. Just go to spectator.co.uk/Evening Blend. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.